Blog Talk Radio.
To Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Chuck Thurston, Marvin Guerin, and Andre Rodatis. Hi, you guys.
Hey, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, all.
Good
morning, Paula.
Yay.
Good morning, everybody.
It's a beautiful day here, and I think it might rain later, but I'm going to enjoy it while I can. We've had a nice wet spring, and it's beautiful here. Flowers everywhere. And, Chuck, you know, you take the most amazing pictures. Oh, my gosh. Chuck walks out his back door and takes these amazing pictures.
Yeah. Got an eye.
You have open space. Yeah,
check him out on Facebook if you haven't kept up with Chuck's pictures there. Absolutely gorgeous, and thank you for that. I always think about, you know, you guys have that great space in Boulder, you and Derek, and you walk out your back door and it backs up to open space, and you get this feeling that you're just in this gigantic prairie, you know, with the mountains in the background.
Yeah, very true.
It's pretty special.
Well, and good view of the cloud activity.
Oh, man. The cloud formations in Boulder are incredible.
Yeah.
What happens over the Flatirons is just, you know. I worked in that office with Mo for years, and Andre knows because he's still in that same building. But Mo and I were on the other side, and it's the tallest building in Boulder, and we were on the sixth floor. And he was like the king of Boulder up there.
That's
like
the
that
Vector
anyway.
Building, right?
Yeah.
You're talking about the Vector. Yeah, I have an office.
Exactly,
there.
The Vector
That's
Bank.
That's the Colorado building, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and the cloud formations,
though.
You could see from that vantage point were just amazing. But when you're this high up, friends, when you're a mile high to begin with, you're a lot closer to the clouds anyway. So that may explain a lot. I don't know. But, well, you know, we just for our listeners' sake, we went back and forth about what to do to start a new study. And at first we talked about the Supreme, and we were going to do the Supreme, and I went and looked at those papers, and there's actually four papers on the Supreme. And I thought, okay, which one should we do? And the more I looked at those papers, the more I realized that so much of what's in there is predicated on a full understanding of what's in the first and part one of the book and even in the foreword. And I didn't know if it would be, you know, good for listeners that don't have that background. And so I wrote back and said, wow, you guys, I don't know. I couldn't even decide which Supreme paper that we might do. And would it be God the Supreme? Or certainly not the Almighty Supreme. You know, and those are amazing papers. And they're, you know, like so many things, they're full of just rich gems of truth. But they also are full of terminology that if you don't have an understanding of what it is, you'll get completely lost in it. And even if you do have an understanding, you can get completely lost in it. So I thought, well, what else could we do? Well, I got this question from a guy last week, and I just wanted to share it with you because I know you guys are, you know, you get a lot of thought-provoking questions from a lot of people. And this one really intrigued me. I haven't seen this one before. His name is Andy. He lives in California, I believe. He says, hi, Paula, this is Andy in California. You've helped me in the past with several perplexing Urantia questions. I have another one. The Urantia book is splattered with what I call heavenly personalities. I think you know who these many functional beings are. I'd like to be able to say I knew that, but anyway, he goes on to say, my contention is in the fact, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there are, quote, ready-made entities. No archangel, no evolution, no growth, no earning of one's identity status. Just instantly made ancients of days, or Archangel Michael, or paradise architects, supreme Trinity personalities, etc. It's like someone here being born president of the U.S. with no childhood, teen or adult experience, and just functions as president. Doesn't seem fair to be given all that authority and power without the experiential growth and maturity. Even the UB says how fortunate we are that we get to be a part of our own evolution through will and growth, unlike the angels. Just seems like God made functional beings, us being the exception, with no free will to deviate from their function, a function preloaded with authority, power, and control. This seems like a robotic universe, not to mention the inequality of personality status. Andy. So I responded, you know, thoughtfully, and he responded again, and then I responded again, and we had a great exchange, as we normally do. But it got me thinking, you know, that's an important question. I wonder if others have thought that. And one of the things that I responded to him was about the evolutionary, the experiential learning of all beings, high and low, and how many of them have to earn their status. And I offered Michael as the prime example, having had to earn the sovereignty of his universe. And then I went, you know, during the volley of question and answer, I went and researched it quite a bit. And it reminds me of the wonderful teaching from the Course in Miracles that says if you would know something, learn it, or teach it to learn it. And when you take on the responsibility of answering someone's question or teaching, then you have to go and research, you know, and find quotes and, you know, make sure that you're given a decent answer here. And so this is why I thought, well, maybe the Ascending Sons of God would be a great paper. So that's why I suggested that, you guys, in case you wondered. It was on my mind. And
you know, there's all kinds of circuitous ways to getting oneself to a particular paper. And that was another wonderful circuitous path. Okay, we have got the paper for you from that. Great. Okay.
Who knew?
I love it.
I didn't even know. I don't know. Don't ask me. It just is, you know, are we in a robotic universe or not?
Oh, hardly.
And
hardly.
And
you know, it's understandable. It's understandable what he's thinking, because I mean the perspective that we have is entirely materialistic. I mean, we do have a view of spirit, but that view of spirit is largely non-experiential. We don't have any great experience of high spirituality. We have a great experience if we're minded to and we're desirous of low-grade spiritual performances. And that doesn't tell us much about what true spiritual dynamism is and what it means to create 21 ancients of days from the get-go that are perfectly suited spiritually and otherwise to do what they do, that they are the judgment of the Paradise Trinity. You know, that can only be from a God who is even more encompassing of reality. And so that's well, well beyond us. We'll all be disabused of that very, very shortly. You know,
so true.
It won't take much time in the next life before we begin to see,
You know, go ahead, Chuck, and then I've got a thought in response to the question that Andy was asking.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah, the last paragraph of paper 75 about Adam and Eve pretty directly addresses what he's saying. That's the paragraph that begins, if this were a mechanistic universe, you know, talking about the default of Adam and Eve, mm-hmm. and what a tragedy that was, yet it demonstrates the fact that this is a universe of free will and mistakes are made, and that that's what gives us this potential for growth and real achievement. And it's true on all levels. So then anyway, that's a good paragraph to look at some point. But anyway, just embedded in that paragraph, kind of a long paragraph, so I won't read it. But in the middle of it, they say, we rejoice that disagreement and misunderstanding are possible, for thereby is evidenced the fact and the act of personality in the universe. And I think that's a kind of a crucial nugget of understanding in all this.
Right.
That even the high beings, even though they may never choose to do the wrong thing, it is a choice that they have, you know, that they make every step of the way, if they're true free will personalities. So we approach it from the bottom up. Maybe they approach it from the top down. But all those principles are still in play.
Right.
You know, the thought I had, and it sounds like a fascinating conversation you and this fellow had. His name was Andy, right?
Andy, yeah.
Yeah. What a great question. I mean, and what a thought. Very thoughtful question. And I had a couple of thoughts while you were sharing his question. One is, I think these beings, and we're going to be talking about the ascending sons of God, and I think what we're talking about is the descending sons of God, in some sense, in a larger sense, although he's asking a more particular question, those who are And the Havona natives are probably the prime example that they describe, who are made, they're perfect in their area of function, in a sense. They're already fully developed in many, many ways that we have to aspire and attain to and work our way toward. But that doesn't mean that, A, they don't have free will and make choices and choose and deliberate all the way along, because they are persons, and every person has free will. And it also doesn't mean that they don't gain experience that enriches them in the descending service to ascending creatures. And I was struck a few weeks ago, you know, I've been in the Urantia University cafes, I've been doing an extended series on in-depth on the adjusters, and something caught me that I had never caught before about the adjusters that relates to this question. And if you're talking about beings that are perfectly made, I mean, the adjusters are God mm-hmm. himself, mm-hmm. right? So how much more perfect and replete can you be? And yet, I want to share a few paragraphs here. There are three paragraphs, but they're very related to this question. And I'd love your guys' thoughts and input, and I'm hoping Andy, whether you share this with him, Paula, or whether he might be listening by any chance, might find this interesting. So they're talking about these adjusters, and they're saying, I have been told, this is 109.12, paragraphs 2, 3, and 4 in 109.1. I have been told by personalized adjusters that every time a monitor indwelt mortal fails of survival, when the adjuster returns to Divinington, an extended course of training is engaged in. Mm-hmm. This additional training is made possible by the experience of having indwelt a human being, and it is always imparted before the adjuster is remanded to the evolutionary worlds of time. So that's an extended course that they engage in after these experiences. Then they go on to make the statement, actual living experience has no cosmic substitute. The perfection of the divinity of a newly formed thought adjuster does not in any manner endow this mystery monitor with experienced ministrative ability. Experience is inseparable from a living existence. It is the one thing which no amount of divine endowment can absolve you from the necessity of securing by actual living. Therefore, in common with all beings living and functioning within the present sphere of the Supreme, thought adjusters must acquire experience. They must evolve from the lower inexperienced to the higher, more experienced groups. Adjusters pass through a definite developmental career in the mortal mind. They achieve a reality of attainment, which is eternally theirs. They progressively acquire adjuster skill and ability as a result of any and all contact with the material races. They are equal partners of the human mind in fostering the evolution of the immortal soul of survival capacity. So I was really struck by that here are these perfect beings, and they grow in experience. Yes.
That was exactly one of the examples that I gave Andy, Marvin. I gave him 109.13, and I underlined, actual living experience has no cosmic substitute. And then I underlined, experience is inseparable from a living existence. It is the one thing which no amount of divine endowment can absolve you from, the necessity mm-hmm. of securing by actual living. But I gave him probably a list of 10 or more, actually more. It was
great.
Paragraphs. Yeah. But I didn't do 1 and 3 in that instance. I just did the, you know, or the middle one. I did 3.
Yeah.
I didn't do 2
which
and 4.
Which is the core of it, really.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And so I just think, you know, descending beings, they're made perfect in their realm, but they gain experience in their descending ministry to us. And they're growing and expanding just as much as we are, they just start from the top and grow downward, and which is interesting. I mean, they gain experience in the realms below them, and we gain experience in the realms above us. But we're all gaining experience,
exactly.
I think, in the partnership. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that's what's so important, I think. And, you know, this was one of the quotes that I gave him that really struck me this time. And it's interesting when you try to answer a question and you go and research it, you get these things that really stand out. And this is from paper 10802. Nothing in the entire universe can substitute for the fact of experience on non-existential levels. The infinite God is, as always, replete and complete, infinitely inclusive of all things except evil and creature experience. God cannot do wrong. He is infallible. God cannot experientially know what he has never personally experienced. What a statement. God's pre-knowledge is existential. Therefore, does the Spirit of the Father descend from paradise to participate with finite mortals in every bona fide experience of the ascending career? It is only by such a method that the existential God could become in truth and in fact man's experiential Father. The infinity of the eternal God encompasses the potential for finite experience, which indeed becomes actual in the ministry of the adjuster fragments that actually share the life vicissitude experiences of human beings. That one really struck me this time in my effort to answer his question, you know. But I ended my list of quotes because this is, to me, it just resonates so deeply. This is, of course, a quote from Jesus. It's from paper 181-24. I have taught you much by word of mouth, and I have lived my life among you. I have done all that can be done to enlighten your minds and liberate your souls. And what you have not been able to get from my teachings and my life, you must now prepare to acquire at the hand of that master of all teachers, actual experience. And in all of this new experience which now awaits you, I will go before you and the Spirit of Truth shall be with you. Fear not. That which you now fail to comprehend, the new teacher, when he has come, will reveal to you throughout the remainder of your life on earth and through your training in the eternal ages. And I told him, and so, Andy, I have concluded that experience is the master teacher, as Jesus says, not only for humans, but for every being in all of creation.
So where did you come to?
Huh?
I was just curious, Paul, maybe look to hear your thoughts, Chuck, but I'm curious where the conversation ended up, how he responded at some point. I'd love to hear it.
Well, he said after I sent him all these quotes, and I told him, I explained, this is a thread that's woven throughout the book. So there are so many instances in which the book describes how all of creation learns by doing, by actual experience. It actually goes without saying that we all experience life, and that experience makes us all wiser. And then I gave him all the quotes, right? And he wrote me back and he said, thanks once again, Paula. All these quotes are power-packed. Not only do these quotes create a shift in me, it is also your labor of love, the aroma that is scented on each of your emails. Thanks so much, Andy. That's where we left it.
Oh, lovely.
But yeah, it's the best part of my job, you guys know. I mean, that I live for that. To be able to share this book with people. And, you know, I don't know, just because I have so much faith in it, I suppose that's obvious, but I try to shine it in the best possible light because I fully understand that, you know, how easily it could be misunderstood. And
I think these interchanges, it's interesting, we began the conversation today about the need to understand the Supreme. I mean, these are the jewels.
Yes.
Of contribution to the emergence of the Supreme. I mean, that conversation will be meaningful for you and Andy, and now for us, you know, into eternity, as part of the emergence of the Supreme. And probably that question has been dealt with numerous times and responded to in different ways throughout the inhabited creations. And I bet you that stuff all gets stored. And anyway, so I guess shared and reshared in many, many ways.
Well, you know, that's probably true for a lot of the things we grapple with on this planet, because there's probably a lot of unusual experiences, given the fact that we live in an unusual, a very unusual circumstance for many reasons. So, you know, they probably, those student visitors, it may be why they like to come here. So, let's see how they deal with this. You know, let's see what they're going to do about that.
You know. Maybe help them figure it out.
Well, yeah, hopefully. Because
in some way,
sometimes out of the mouths of babes, when you don't know, you just improvise, and sometimes that's some pretty cool stuff comes out of that.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that I came across an interesting paragraph just recently, and I was looking for something else, as often happens. But regarding this, what you're saying about adjusters, even though they're created as, you know, or come into existence, let's say, as perfect divine fragments of the nature of God, yet through experience they develop. And I've never thought about this, but apparently the same is true in a way of the Havona natives. You know, I always thought of them as, well, they're created perfect and, you know, they're done, right? But that's apparently not quite the case. So, you know, your friend might be interested in this as well, because I think he brought up maybe the Havona natives as an example of a type of being who is created perfect and then has nothing else to do. But that's, maybe I could just read a paragraph here that kind of addresses that in a really interesting way. So this is in paper 32. Section 3, paragraph 12, where it says, in the universes encircling Havona, there are provided only a sufficient number of perfect creatures to meet the need for patterned teacher guides for those who are ascending the evolutionary scale of life. The experiential nature of the evolutionary type of personality is the natural cosmic complement of the ever-perfect natures of the paradise Havona creatures. In reality, both perfect and perfected creatures are incomplete as regards finite totality. But in the complemental association of the existentially perfect creatures of the paradise Havona system with the experientially perfected finalities ascending from the evolutionary universes, both types find release from inherent limitations and thus may conjointly attempt to reach the sublime heights of the ultimate of creature status. And then this last little short paragraph ends that section. They say, the two prime manifestations of finite reality, innate perfection and evolved perfection, be they personalities or universes, are coordinate, dependent, and integrated. Each requires the other to achieve completion of function, service, and destiny. So I thought that was pretty cool.
That's a good one.
That whole section is interesting, but this idea that new potentials arise from the complemental association of perfect and the perfected.
That's an experience that both have.
Two prime manifestations of finite reality. Mm-hmm. Innate perfection and evolved perfection. And they end up having a cosmically complemental association with these beings, these pattern teachers.
Sounds wonderful.
You know, there's another example.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead, Chuck. Finish up.
Oh, no. But that points to a level of achievement that even a these perfected beings of Avona is still held out in front of them as a higher potential for achievement, even for being created in perfection.
Yeah, you know, there's another much more minor example, but it's interesting because it's really related to our experiences. And I can't remember where or how to find it. Maybe you all could put your finger on it quickly. But it's the place where it says that mortal ascenders who hail from, let's say, the more advanced spheres of light and life often are repersonalized on the higher mansion worlds or and even the Jerusalem headquarters. But what they're required to do before they begin their ascent in earnest is to go back and cover and help teach and help minister to those beings who come from more primitive worlds. They have to go back to the earlier mansion worlds and actually experience those areas that they sort of skipped, in a sense, and cover those experientially in some sense by,
yeah,
in a sense, becoming descending beings for a short stretch going back. So that's an interesting allusion to the same principle that you are articulating, I think, Chuck, as well.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
55.311.
Wow, that's a good one, Andre.
There is a certain inevitable penalty attaching to mortal existence on such advanced evolutionary planets. When a settled world progresses beyond the third stage of light and life, all ascenders are destined, before attaining the minor sector, to receive some sort of transient assignment on a planet passing through the earlier stages of evolution.
Mm. Yeah. And there's another quote that I couldn't find that I wanted to, you know, just reread myself as I was preparing, you know, an answer for Andy, and that was the one that talks about how the Havona, how the perfect beings of Havona envy us. Do you remember that one, you guys? I can't find it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For
that's
all of our
one.
Long journey, you know, and I really wanted to just look that
you
one at that one
bottom?
Again.
Oh, man.
I know. Huh. You got to.
3517.
Yay.
Paula?
Thanks, Andre.
It's 3517.
Okay.
Yeah.
Read it, Andre, just for kicks, and we can start.
The creatures of Havona are naturally brave, but they are not courageous in the human sense. They are innately kind and considerate, but hardly altruistic in the human way. They are expectant of a pleasant future, but not hopeful in the exquisite manner of the trusting mortal of the uncertain evolutionary spheres. They have faith in the stability of the universe, but they are utter strangers to that saving faith whereby mortal man climbs from the status of an animal up to the portals of paradise. They love the truth, but they know nothing of its soul-saving qualities. They're idealists. But they were born that way. They are wholly ignorant of the ecstasy of becoming such by exhilarating choice. They are loyal, but they have never experienced the thrill of wholehearted and intelligent devotion to duty in the face of temptation to default. They are unselfish, but they never gain such levels of experience by the magnificent conquests of a belligerent self. They enjoy pleasure, but they do not comprehend the sweetness of the pleasure escape from the pain potential.
Wow.
Well, then maybe that's pointing to their incompleteness. You know, they came up in what I read, where they talk about how the Havona beings are incomplete. And it's in their association with us that they find the opportunity for a higher level of realization somehow.
Huh. Well, that was a great one. Thank you, guys. I might take those two or three that you guys added and send those to Andy, too. I think he'll love them.
Mm.
You can save the chat.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I'll save the chat. Good idea. Yay. So thank you for indulging me in that and to read this paper, The Ascending Sons of God. It's you know, when I went to write the blurb, I like to go to David Cantor's contribution to the internet use of the Urantia book, and that is what many readers really, really like. He called it the new book, and it has cross references, and it has the synopsis, and it has the audio version, and it's all right there in one nice little place, and people like it because they can read and listen as they're reading, and he breaks it up in a unique way, and this paper kind of stands alone in his divisions. This paper stands alone, so I thought that was interesting, and maybe share how he groups them.
Are you speaking of a website?
Well, it's from the fellowship, and it's David's contribution. It's integrated with the topical index. Each paper, you know, has the audio version, and it's actually urantia-book.org/new-book. And so he breaks them up when you're looking at them, and you see, you know, the nature of God, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and then the eternal Son, 6 and 7, the infinite Spirit, 8 and 9, the Trinity, 10, geography of the cosmos, paper 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15, personalities of the origin in paradise deities, 16 and 17. So he breaks it up in his own unique way, and as he understands it. And this paper, paper 40, just stands alone as ascending personalities. And then from there, it's more physical cosmology of the local universe, and then you get to part 3. So I just thought that was interesting. And go ahead, Marvin.
No, you please finish, Paula.
No, I was done.
Okay. I don't know if we want to read it, but there is another section that I often, especially for new readers, it's a part of the new reader course, that's connected with this paper on the Ascending Sons of God, and that is section 30, paper 30, section 4 on the Ascending Mortals, which is the first time in the book where it gives a very nice synopsis of what we experience all the way through from here to paradise. And you know, it's a longish section, but it's really fun and juicy and it's very good introductory material, and it's very related.
Fun and juicy?
Yeah.
That's a good way to describe it.
Is this a commercial for steak or for juicy fruit? I don't know. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah,
it has a lot of sizzle.
Yeah. It's sort of how this ascended experience tenderizes us in a sense. But
All right.
Anyways, I don't know if we want to read it at some point, but it's sort of connected to this paper. It's a different paper, but it's a nice synopsis.
Go ahead. Why not?
Okay. So I don't know if you guys want to do that. We could start there. It's
okay.
Where are you? Give us a citation.
It's 30, section 4, The Ascending Mortals.
Oh, okay, yeah, in the personality records of the grand universe. Yeah, okay, good.
Yeah, it's at the end of that one. You know, if you guys want to do that, I mean, it just occurred to me,
no,
it's quite associated.
It's a nice
30,
preview.
Section 4.
Yeah.
Sure,
yeah.
That's fine with me. Okay.
Okay. So it's entitled The Ascending Mortals, which is us. adjuster fused mortals. While the mortal survivors of time and space are denominated ascending pilgrims when accredited for the progressive ascent to paradise, these evolutionary creatures occupy such an important place in these narratives, meaning the Urantia book, that we here desire to present a synopsis of the following seven stages of the ascending universe career. 1, planetary mortals. 2, sleeping survivors. 3, mansion world students. 4, Urantia progressors. 5, super universe wards. 6, Havona pilgrims. And 7, paradise arrivals. The following narrative presents the universe career of an adjuster indwelt mortal. The sun and spirit fused mortals share portions of this career, but we have elected to tell this story as it pertains to the adjuster fused mortals, for such a destiny may be anticipated by all of the human races of Urantia. 1, planetary mortals. I'm just looking. This is a pretty long section, so we may split it. You know, I may read part of it, and maybe we can split it up. One, planetary mortals. Mortals are all animal origin evolutionary beings of ascendant potential. In origin, nature, and destiny, these various groups and types of human beings are not wholly unlike the Urantia peoples. The human races of each world receive the same ministry of the sons of God and enjoy the presence of the ministering spirits of time. After natural death, all types of ascenders fraternize as one Urantia family on the mansion worlds. So planetary mortals. And then section 2, number 2 is sleeping survivors. All mortals of survival status, in the custody of personal guardians of destiny, pass through the portals of natural death, and on the third period, personalize on the mansion worlds. Those accredited beings who have, for any reason, been unable to attain that level of intelligence mastery and endowment of spirituality, which would entitle them to personal guardians, cannot thus immediately and directly go to the mansion worlds. Someone may want to mute. There's typing that's coming through there. Such surviving souls may rest in unconscious sleep until the judgment day of a new epoch, a new dispensation, the coming of a son of God to call the rolls of the age and adjudicate the realm. And this is the general practice throughout all Mevedon. It was said of Christ Michael that when he ascended on high at the conclusion of his work on earth, he led a great multitude of captives, and these captives were the sleeping survivors from the days of Adam to the day of the Master's resurrection on Urantia. The passing of time is of no moment to sleeping mortals. They are wholly unconscious and oblivious to the length of their rest. On reassembly of personality at the end of an age, those who have slept 5,000 years will react no differently than those who have rested 5 days. Aside from this time delay, these survivors pass on through the ascension regime identically with those who avoid the longer or shorter sleep of death. These dispensational classes of world pilgrims are utilized for group Urantia activities in the work of the local universes. There is a great advantage in the mobilization of such enormous groups. They are thus kept together for long periods of effective service. So that's the sleeping survivors. And then the third section, I don't know if one of you wants to read on the mansion world students.
I'll read it.
Yeah, go on.
Number three, Mansion World students. All surviving mortals who reawaken on the Mansion Worlds belong to this class. The physical body of mortal flesh is not a part of the reassembly of the sleeping survivor. The physical body has returned to the dust. The Seraphim of Assignment sponsors the new body, the Marantia form, as the new life vehicle for the immortal soul and for the indwelling of the returned adjuster. The adjuster is the custodian of the spirit transcript of the mind of the sleeping survivor. The assigned seraphim is the keeper of the surviving identity, the immortal soul, as far as it has evolved. And when these two, the adjuster and the seraphim, reunite their personality trusts, the new individual constitutes the resurrection of the old personality, the survival of the evolving Marantia identity of the soul. Such a reassociation of soul and adjuster is quite properly called a resurrection, a reassembly of personality factors. But even this does not entirely explain the reappearance of the surviving personality. Though you will probably never understand the fact of such an inexplicable transaction, you will sometime experientially know the truth of it if you do not reject the plan of mortal survival. The plan of initial mortal detention on seven worlds of progressive training is nearly universal in Orvantan. In each local system of approximately 1,000 inhabited planets, there are seven mansion worlds, usually satellites or sub-satellites of the system capital. They are the receiving worlds for the majority of ascending mortals. Sometimes all training worlds of mortal residents are called universe, quote, mansions. And it was to such spheres that Jesus alluded when he said, "In my Father's house are many mansions." From here on, within a given group of spheres like the mansion worlds, ascenders will progress individually from one sphere to another and from one phase of life to another. But they will always advance from one stage of universe study to another in class formation. Shall I read another one?
Yeah.
These sections are so, they're really good.
Well, they're good prep for what we're going to be going through, and why not? You know, in
why
for
not?
A penny, in for a pound, I say.
Okay. Good. Yay. I'm with you with that. So for Marantia Progressors. From the mansion worlds on up through the spheres of the system, constellation, and the universe, mortals are classed as Marantia progressors. They are traversing the transition spheres of mortal ascension. As the ascending mortals progress from the lower to the higher of the Marantia worlds, they serve on countless assignments in association with their teachers and in company with their more advanced and senior brethren. Marantia progression pertains to continuing advancement of intellect, spirit, and personality form. Survivors are still three-natured beings. Throughout the entire Marantia experience, they are wards of the local universe. The regime of the super-universe does not function until the spirit career begins. Mortals acquire real spirit identity just before they leave the local universe headquarters for the receiving worlds of the minor sectors of the super universe. Passing from the final Marantia stage to the first or lowest spirit status is but a slight transition. The mind, personality, and character are unchanged by such an advance. Only does the form undergo modification. Only does the form undergo modification. But the spirit form is just as real as the Marantia body, and it is equally discernible. before departing from their native local universes for the super universe receiving worlds, the mortals of time are recipients of spirit confirmation from the Creator Son and the local universe Mother Spirit. From this point on, the status of the ascending mortal is forever settled. Super universe wards have never been known to go astray. Ascending seraphim are also advanced in angelic standing at the time of their departure from the local universe. Somebody else want to read? Chuck, you want to take
there,
fire?
Chuck, or do you want me to read?
Sure, yeah, I can pick up. I can pick up.
Go ahead.
Here. Okay, super universe ward.
Yeah.
I believe is where we are. All
yep.
ascenders arriving on the training worlds of the super universes become the wards of the Ancients of Days. They have traversed the Marantia life of the local universe and are now accredited spirits. Wow, you get a little pin or a badge. Anyway, we got our accreditation papers. As young spirits, they begin the ascension of the super universe system of training and culture, extending from the receiving spheres of their minor sector in through the study worlds of the 10 major sectors and on to the higher cultural spheres of the super universe headquarters. There are three orders of student spirits in accordance with their sojourn upon the minor sector, major sector, in the super universe headquarters worlds of spirit progression. As Marantia ascenders studied and worked on the worlds of the local universe, so spirit ascenders continue to master new worlds while they practice at giving out to others that which they have imbibed at the experiential fonts of wisdom. Interesting phrasing there. But going to school as a spirit being in the super universe career is very unlike anything that has ever entered the imaginative realms of the material mind of man. Mm-hmm. Before leaving the super universe for Havona, these ascending spirits received the same thorough course in super universe management that they received during their Marantia experience in local universe supervision. Before spirit mortals reach Havona, their chief study, but not exclusive occupation, is the mastery of local and super universe administration. The reason for all this experience is not now fully apparent, but no doubt such training is wise and necessary in view of their possible future destiny as members of the core of the finality. Wow. I think we'll have better memories then. It sounds like. Anyway, the super universe regime is not the same for all ascending mortals. They receive the same general education, but special groups and classes are carried through special courses of instruction and are put through specific courses of training. Maybe I'll just read one more. I'll read six, too. Okay, then there's the Havona pilgrims. When spirit development is complete, even though not replete, interesting, then the surviving mortal prepares for the long flight to Havona, the haven of evolutionary spirits. On Earth, you are a creature of flesh and blood. Through the local universe, you were a Marantia being. Through the super universe, you were an evolving spirit. With your arrival on the receiving worlds of Havona, your spiritual education begins in reality and in earnest. Your eventual appearance on paradise will be as a perfected spirit. The journey from the super universe headquarters to the Havona receiving spheres is always made alone. From now on, no more class or group instruction will be administered. You are through with the technical and administrative training of the evolutionary world of time and space. Now begins your personal education, your individual spiritual training. From first to last, throughout all Havona, the instruction is personal and threefold in nature: intellectual, spiritual, and experiential. The first act of your Havona career will be to recognize and thank your transport Sakonifum for the long and safe journey. Hey. Then you are presented to those beings who will sponsor your early Havona activities. Next, you go to register your arrival and prepare your message of thanksgiving and adoration for dispatch to the Creator Son of your local universe, the Universe Father who made possible your sonship career. This concludes the formalities of the Havona arrival, whereupon you are accorded a long period of leisure and for free observation. And this affords opportunity for looking up your friends, fellows, and associates of the long ascension experience. You may also consult the broadcast to ascertain who of your fellow pilgrims have departed for Havona since the time of your leaving Uversa. It's the time of your leaving Uversa. Sounds like maybe it's a long trip. The fact of your arrival.
Oh, it's a long trip.
The fact of your arrival on the receiving worlds of Havona will be duly transmitted to the headquarters of your local universe and personally conveyed to your seraphic guardian, wherever that seraphim may chance to be. The ascended mortals have been thoroughly trained in the affairs of the evolutionary worlds of space. Now they begin their long and profitable contact with the created spheres of perfection. What a preparation for some future work is afforded by this combined, unique, and extraordinary experience! But I cannot tell you, about Havona. You must see these worlds to appreciate their glory or to understand their grandeur.
Keep in mind that, this is, again, written by a mighty messenger, so... she has experienced all of this.
Yeah.
He knows whereof he or she speaks.
Right.
Andre, you want to finish it off?
Sure.
Paradise Arrivals.
On reaching paradise with residential status, you begin the progressive course in divinity and obscenity. Your residence on paradise signifies that you have found God and that you are to be mustered into the mortal core of the finality. Of all the creatures of the grand universe, only those who are father fused are mustered into the mortal core of the finality. Only such individuals take the finaliter oath. Other beings of paradise perfection or attainment may be temporarily attached to this finality core, but they are not of eternal assignment to the unknown and unrevealed mission of this accumulating host of the evolutionary and perfected veterans of time and space. Paradise arrivals are accorded a period of freedom, after which they begin their associations with the seven groups of the primary Supernifum. They are designated paradise graduates when they have finished their course with the conductors of worship, and then as finaliters are assigned on observational and cooperative service to the ends of the far-flung creation. As yet, there seems to be no specific or settled employment for the mortal core of finaliters, though they serve in many capacities on worlds settled in light and life. If there should be no future or unrevealed destiny for the mortal core of the finality, the present assignment of these ascendant beings would be altogether adequate and glorious. Their present destiny wholly justifies the universal plan of evolutionary ascent, But the future ages of the evolution of the spheres of outer space will undoubtedly further elaborate and with more repleteness divinely illuminate the wisdom and loving kindness of the gods in the execution of their divine plan of human survival and mortal ascension. This narrative, together with what has been revealed to you and with what you may acquire in connection with instruction respecting your own world, presents an outline of the career of an ascending mortal. The story varies considerably in the different superuniverses, but this recital affords a glimpse of the average plan of mortal progression as it is operative in the local universe of Nebadon and in the seventh segment of the grand universe, the superuniverse of Orvontan, sponsored by a mighty messenger from Universa.
It's quite a recap of a long, long career.
I mean, this makes it seem like it's going to take it's a hop, skip, and a jump, pretty much, right? Seven stages and we're done.
Exactly.
Pretty quick.
But no.
Well, just to underscore Chuck's point of the long trip, you know?
Yeah. That
trip is coming from Universa. Universa is at the center of Orvontan. Now, what do we know about the ragged edge of Orvontan? The ragged edge of Orvontan is out somewhere in the neighborhood of 240 to 250,000 light years. Okay?
Yeah.
That's just to get from Universa to the inner margin of Havona. Okay, actually the outer margin of the super universe. Then we need to cross some indeterminate space region. We're not sure how much space there is before the first band of dark gravity bodies. My calculation is that band of dark gravity bodies is about only a mere 60 light years across, give or take. Then another expanse of space that's indeterminate, and then another inner body of dark gravity bodies that is probably about 300 light years across, and then some other indeterminate amount of space before we get to the seventh circuit of Havona. And there's no telling where the pilot world is in that circuit, okay? I mean, the Sakonifim knows, but it's not a given that it's right in the direction of Orvontan. It could be on the other side of Havona as you're making your trip. Those worlds don't stop for you. So that Sakonifim may have to traverse Havona to get to the other side of Havona to get to the pilot world, or it might be just happening to line up when you're getting there. So that just to look at the technicality of that, that's at least probably, a 300, it could be less than 300,000 light years, but it could be much more if that world is on the other side. And that's, therefore, by definition, a long trip.
A very long trip.
That's just the trip. And so you can imagine, when they say you can consult the broadcasts to see where your fellows
associates
might be in the journey, you may have been traveling for hundreds of years. We don't know how relativity and all of that functions. If you're a Halversonian, you believe that this is, if it's triple velocity that Sakonifim go, then it could be, 100,000 years that you're traveling. But I don't hold to that theory. I hold to a different view of that. But in any event.
Well, I like where they say time is of no moment to sleeping survivors. So, you know, I mean, and I think time is of no moment to them. I think their whole perception of time is vastly different than ours. And so, you know, that endlessly intrigued me. But one thing that I was touched by, you know, when you talk about the long, long trip, we have to thank our Sikonophones. Like, whew, thank you. That was a long trip.
Yeah.
But the next thing is we go to register our arrival and prepare our message of thanksgiving and adoration for dispatch to the Creator Son of the local universe, the universe Father who made possible your sonship career. You know, I was just struck when we read that. I'm going to do that now. I'm just going to do it now, and then I'll do it then. And maybe by some dispensation of grace, they'll let me see what my little creature mind and heart had to say back on your ranch and when I thanked my Creator Son for making my sonship career possible.
Mm-hmm.
And it just occurred to me that would be a good thing to do now. Because I haven't done that yet. And
it's a wonderful exercise, yeah. It's like a letter to God type thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Only it's a letter to Michael. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, what a...
Wait a minute.
Is that the arrival at Havona sound?
Yeah, right. You've arrived. The lights are flashing.
You have arrived.
Oh, okay.
Someone is trying to reach you.
Oh.
It's been
These
a
comments
while.
About our administrative training are also pretty interesting, I think,
mm-hmm.
that we go through apparently so much of that. You know, the course is not only in local universe, but super universe administration and supervision. That's apparently we go through a very extensive study of that. And then they say the reason for all this is not now fully apparent. But no doubt such training is wise and necessary. So that points kind of between the lines, I think, to our service in the outer space levels.
Yeah.
Where there's going to be tremendous administrative challenges associated with whatever is going to go on out there.
How does that strike
Absolutely.
You? I mean, I'm really struck by that. It's like, wow, it doesn't seem possible. You know?
What's that?
Oh, administrating a universe.
Yeah.
You that's literally what Michael does. So it speaks to the level of training that goes on, that you will and can be trained to that degree. Seems
and the level of
at
trust.
This point, but yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, that's
well, I think
the bigger
there are
deal.
Also.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's so much that's packed into this description, and it's interesting that they give this to us pretty early on. I mean, this is in part one. They give us sort of a broad overview. But part of what's packed into what happens to us along the way is very early on, we fuse with this fragment of God, and so we become a combined, even at the earliest points, we become a combined human and divine being, in a sense. So there's a radical transformation of our nature, even at the very bottom of this whole series of experiences. And so as we go through this experience, we're a single fused being that is part God. You know, so that's for me is part of the explanation, which is so beyond my current conception. I mean, I can understand that theoretically, but to actually experience that fusion and come out the other side and be changed into a combination of divinity and humanity, that's astounding right there. And then we go through this experience where we're exposed to administering and teaching and serving for endless eons that I'm sure will change us and evolve us in ways we can't imagine. And then, you know, either through the Trinity embrace or through reaching what they call seven-stage spirit status, we will somehow merge. They tell us that just as we have fused with the presence of the Father and become one with God in that sense and become a combined being in that sense, we will somehow also merge with the Supreme and partake of all finite experience during the age of the Supreme. Somehow we'll have access to all of that. So, you know, when you say, Paula, it's almost inconceivable. It is inconceivable how we could function as almost deities, which is strange to even think about, out in the universes of outer space, where they say there are literally trillions of galaxies like our seven super universes, either billions or trillions. That's a lot of lot of space to administer in the age of the ultimate. And I just think we will be so changed, so transformed by this experience. And that's God's intention, is to make us like him and to partake of his nature, that it really is almost impossible to imagine at this stage, which is natural, I guess. But they say this is what's going to happen. This is what's going to happen for us.
It's pretty tough. Go ahead, Chuck.
Oh, it kind of goes along with this comment they make about when we arrive on Havana. They say our spirit development is complete. You know, our achievement of that seventh stage spirit status, apparently. Our spirit development is complete, even though not replete. So that's interesting distinction and meaning there. And then they go on to say that, you know, your spiritual education on the moment, your arrival, your spiritual education begins in reality and in earnest. So that you eventually appear on paradise as a perfected spirit. So we go from a completion of spirit development through this long billion world progression to become a perfected spirit. So the thought that our spiritual education begins in earnest when we arrive on Havana, as if it hasn't been ongoing already, is pretty interesting. It's pretty interesting, I think. Okay, let's get to work. Let's make this real, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Are we having fun yet?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, you know, the reason I guess that it just so strikes me is that, you know, before we came on the air, we were talking about clearing out the junk that accumulates around us as humans, right? And and that sometimes is really a challenge, just to administer our own lives, our own little mortal situation, you know, that we find ourselves in, or you know, I think of someone like Mo, who has been the CEO of a company, or my dear friend John. You know, they're both dear friends, Mo and John Hay. Same thing, you know, to be able to have the command of managing that many different aspects of a company and what all needs to be done and get it all just organized and right and, you know, be able to oversee all of it and know what's happening and what needs to happen and when it needs to happen and how it needs to happen. And I mean, that's no easy thing. And I often have thought about Michael in the universe and thought about him administering a universe and thought, how does he have time for me, for my prayer, you know, for my little human self? You know, but he did pour out his spirit. But, you know, and it's hard not to anthropomorphize your small human experience so that you can, you know. But I do look at that and think, does he have a secretary? You know.
He probably has more than one, I imagine.
You know, because I think of people at on a high level of administration on this world and how challenging and difficult it is to keep everything in order. Marvin once, you know, likened it to spinning plates, and it's like that, you know, when you have a lot of responsibility. You don't want to let anything drop. But when you're a master like Jesus, then you can do it, and that's what we're becoming. No wonder it takes so long to go from here to there, you know?
Wasn't one of Michael's bestowals as a like a teacher assistant, something like that? Something like
that,
sort of like a glorified secretary?
Yeah.
As a supreme seraphim, you know, he certainly was,
Yeah,
he was of the fourth order of supreme seraphim. So he was a, what do they call them, the teaching counselors?
Yeah.
Something like that, yeah. I mean, that's not on the universe scale, but it kind of points to a similar kind of arrangement of functional responsibilities that are delegated and organized, you know, to support these enterprises. I mean, the kind of things we're reading about here, you know, entail countless beings who have to all act in cooperation and understanding. And that's from my small experience with having a company, the biggest challenge is not getting the work done, it's managing the employees.
Oh, absolutely. all the different personalities.
Right, all these personality relationships and all these you know, quirky individuals who, you know, all have their own thoughts about everything, right?
their own ways of doing things.
Sure.
Yeah.
So thinking about that on a universe scale is pretty mind-boggling. But it kind of makes sense as to why it would require so much training to become gifted, to become, you know, to achieve mastery and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Well, that's why they pay Michael the big bucks.
you know? Right, the big bucks.
He earns them. Well, can we move on to paper 40 and just begin
maybe get
the zero section and section one in, and then
let's
because
jump
this
in.
Is we're going to be talking about, you know, those ascenders who ascend with us. And not just us, but others who are ascending as well. And there's a fascination of that, I think.
Yeah.
So I wanted to add one more thing that struck me from what we just read, and that was that they send the seraphim a message. You've arrived!
Yeah.
You know, they keep your seraphim in the loop because they're interested. They care. They're like mom and dad. Mom and dad want to know every little milestone you achieve in life, you know, if you care to share that with them. And, you know, so I thought that was touching. And those, you know, I often think that those natural things that we do are borrowed from the universe, from the love of the universe, you know. We borrow those from the love of our creator and the love of the organization and loving beings and associations that are inherent in our loving universe.
Yeah.
It's not something
very
we came
good point.
Up with. Yeah.
What's amazing is they get that message to that seraphim wherever they are in the
wherever
grand universe.
Wherever they are, yes. Because they're interested. They want to know. they want to be apprised of our progress.
Yeah. They aren't
one of the most intimate relationships we have, I think, is with our seraphim.
Yeah.
You know, as
so
our
primary.
Ascension progresses, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even now, who knows us better than they do?
No, they know us better than we know ourselves.
Right.
Oh, God. Yeah.
They make that statement that this life, I think in association with what you were saying, Paula, this life is kind of a rehearsal or a period of practice where we're sort of playing at being adults in a sense in relation to many of the things that we'll be doing in a much higher way as even in the next stage of existence. So, yeah, I agree with you. I think some of these sentiments of that we have in our relationships with each other are just foreshadowings of stuff we'll be doing all along the way in higher forms.
Yeah, absolutely. We borrow that from our loving universe. It's a foreshadowing is a good way to describe it. Okay, so who would like to read the zero section? What would you call that? The preamble?
The introductory section.
The introductory section, perfect. In paper 40.
It's the zero section too, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll be glad to, if nobody else
would. Okay. Great, thanks.
All right.
Andre.
Paper 40, The Ascending Sons of God. As in many of the major groups of universe beings, seven general classes of the ascending sons of God have been revealed. 1. Father-fused mortals. 2. Son-fused mortals. 3. Spirit-fused mortals. 4. Evolutionary seraphim. 5. Ascending material sons. 6. Translated midwares. 7. Personalized adjusters. The story of these beings, from the lowly animal origin mortals of the evolutionary worlds to the personalized adjusters of the Universal Father, present a glorious recital of the unstinted bestowal of divine love and gracious condescension throughout all time and in all universes of the far-flung creation of the paradise deities. These presentations began with a description of the deities, and group by group, the narrative has descended the universal scale of living beings until it has reached the lowest order of life endowed with the potential of immortality. And now am I dispatched from Salvington, one time a mortal of origin on an evolutionary world of space, to elaborate and continue the recital of the eternal purpose of the gods respecting the ascending orders of sonship, more particularly with regard to the mortal creatures of time and space. Since the greater part of this narrative will be devoted to a discussion of the three basic orders of ascending mortals, consideration will first be given to the non-mortal ascending orders of sonship, seraphic, Adamic, midware, and adjuster. And just so you know, this is a mighty messenger again.
Yeah. He does know whereof he speaks. Go ahead and read one, too, Andre.
Okay. I'm just noting that they include the adjuster as an ascending order of sonship.
The personalized.
Personalized adjusters, yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And, of course, the adjuster as fused with mortals. But
yeah.
Right. Right.
Good
yeah.
point.
So, 1, evolutionary seraphim. Mortal creatures of animal origin are not the only beings privileged to enjoy sonship. The angelic hosts also share the supernal opportunity to attain paradise. Guardian seraphim, through experience and service with the ascending mortals of time, also achieve the status of ascendant sonship. Such angels attain paradise through seraphington, and many are even mustered into the core of mortal finality. To climb to the supernal heights of finality or sonship with God is a masterly achievement for an angel, an accomplishment far transcending your attainment of eternal survival through the plan of the eternal Son and the ever-present help of the indwelling adjuster. But the guardian seraphim and occasionally others do actually affect such ascensions.
Any thoughts on that? Are they actually saying that it's harder for them because they don't
yes.
have a thought adjuster? Is that what they're, do you think that's what they're getting at?
I think that's part of it.
Mm.
I think that may be part of it. May have other things to do as well, because they're
they're trying to ascend through a realm that is to an achievement that is not necessarily designed. I'm not saying that it's not designed for their order of creatures. That's probably misspeaking, but it is designed for us, definitely.
Right. And they are different from us.
And it is one of their possible goals to achieve, but many, many more make the circles of Serafington. And that is also a high achievement, but that's one that's definitely designed for them and one to which we can never aspire.
And it's interesting, too, that they state that we're not the only ones to enjoy sonship, and it's one of those things. I mean, this, as I read the Urantia book, I often think about conceptually the language they had to use, right? I guess I'm just naturally sympathetic with them because I understand that they're trying to teach us some concept. And the concept, for instance, in this instance, is the child-parent relationship. And so they chose the word sonship to as representative of that concept, the concept of the child-parent relationship. And I fully appreciate that's the word symbol they chose for that concept. I don't feel slighted by it. I don't feel like they're ignoring me as a female. You know, not at all. Because I understand, I guess, inherently how difficult it would be to teach us some of the things that they're trying to teach us. And so I guess I say that because somebody might say, well, I thought angels were the daughters of God. Well, that's another, you know, they've equated that to create an understanding in our minds of something. But they can achieve, what they're saying is they can achieve sonship and enjoy sonship just as we do. So it's interesting that they say it that way, or that he says it, the mighty messenger.
And that mighty messenger might have been a former female. But,
the
deal
yeah.
here is they are not talking about hormonal proclivities. Let's face it, folks. What we're talking about when we're talking about male and female is talking about how our hormonal proclivities skew our natures and our thinking and our behavior and all of that.
And so
and that's all I'll say about that.
Yeah. Well,
thank you for it.
Complimentary. Well, they, you know, they do say,
oh, Lord, put a watch on my tongue.
I think they do say, and I couldn't put my finger on it, that at some other place in the book, that when a guardian seraphim begins the ascent, they actually shift out of one category into another. They were classed as the daughters of God and descend a descending order, in a sense, ministering to beings lower than themselves. And they switch status and they become... they move into becoming an order of the ascending sons of God. So they move from descending to ascending. They're now beginning the journey upward through experiences that they have not attained. But they also move from the status of the daughters of God to the status of the sons of God, which is, speaking to your point, Paula, they mean some things by those designations that are far more
meaningful.
Meaningful and cosmically implying with cosmic implications than we really have any sense of. For one thing that strikes me, and I can only put words to it very vaguely, when they talk about the Universal Father, the Eternal Son, and the Infinite Spirit, they talk about very different realms of structuring the nature of beings. Let me try and capture it that way. When they talk about a son of God, they talk about a discrete person that has qualities but also limitations as a person. So, for instance, they say the eternal son is not connected up with other sons of God in the way the circuitry of the third person of deity encircuits all of her children, in a sense, his or her children. And the same is true of the mother spirit and the angels. So sons of God are, in some sense, my takeaway is that they are discrete and separate beings in a way that the angelic orders are different. The angelic orders are part of a circuitry, in a sense, that emanates from the infinite spirit and then the universe mother spirit. They're almost like part of a whole, in a way that a son is separate and individual.
That's interesting, Marvin.
And those are just very vague kind of associations I have with those terms. But it is different. There is a difference, and I think these nuances are things we're going to be learning about in ways we can hardly imagine all the way up, because they say the differences and the distinctions between male and female, son, daughter, you know, the different grand classifications of beings are things that we're going to be learning about all the way, you know, into eternity. Mm-hmm. It's an endless subject of fascination and discovery.
I
very much agree with you. Yeah, I think we have almost nothing in the way of an understanding of what they're trying to get across by using these different terms in our English language.
I think
we grasp so little of it.
Amen, Marvin.
Yes. And it's not about sex, as Andre pointed out. It has nothing to do with that. Nothing to do with that. You know? And
I often think of the way they deal with deity as gender fluid in the Urantia book, we use that term. So, for instance, they use terms like the eternal mother son. That's basically saying, forget your categories, guys. There are qualities to deity and qualities to all of us as beings that flow across these boundaries, and get used to it. You know, Carl Jung got to this in its initial sense when he said an androgynous human being is a man who discovers his feminine nature and integrates it into the way he functions and lives, and a woman who discovers her masculine nature, and it escapes, like you said, Andre, we're not talking about hormones. We're talking about essential qualities that we tend to associate with those terms. And they're saying, even at this early stage, Jung was saying, maturity means integrating these different qualities. So just as an example of the gender fluidity here, they talk about an angelic pair, like the guardian seraphim, as positive and negative, and they associate that with the masculine feminine, right? And yet, here is this pair moving from the status of a daughter of God to the status of an ascending son of God, and so there's shifts all over the place, right, ways that force us to get much more creative and free-thinking about the qualities they're trying to get to, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know,
well put.
Here's another example of language that struck me as you were reading the zero section, Andre. It's from paragraph 9, the story of these beings from the lowly animal origin mortals of the evolutionary worlds to the personalized adjusters of the universal father presents a glorious recital of the unstinted bestowal of divine love and gracious condescension. To me, that those two words together, gracious condescension, because they are descending. And, you know, if I were to say that's condescending, that's a very negative connotation. But
yeah.
In their nature, there is a gracious condescension. And I think that, just that phrase alone, there's such an important concept for us mortals to understand. There is a gracious way to condescend. Any teacher knows this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something to achieve in our lives, to
yeah.
be gracious in our condescension, especially if we know something that someone else doesn't know. Or, you know, we hold power. Here's a great example. We hold power over them, which these the high beings of the universe hold power over us. We don't even fathom how much. But when you hold
sure.
power over another being, you can either, you know, abuse that power and use it for self-aggrandizement, or you can have a gracious condescension that seeks to
right.
do nothing but uplift everything beneath you. And,
well,
you know,
go ahead, please.
I just love that, that phrase, gracious, throughout all time and in all universes of the far-flung creation of the paradise deities, a gracious condescension. That's what I feel coming through the Urantia book in spades.
Mm-hmm.
Well, take a look at this just as an example of the nuance of the concept they're trying to convey to us and how they use language, right? That word condescension, right? What an interesting word. The con meaning with, in a sense, a descending, right?
Yeah.
A moving from higher to lower. Look at the next paragraph, right, as they elaborate on that idea. And look how there's an allusion to who's speaking these words, right?
Right.
It's what they say is these presentations, meaning from the beginning of part one, right,
right,
began with a description of the deities, and group by group, the narrative has descended the universal scale of living beings until it has reached the lowest order of life, meaning you guys who I'm talking to now,
yeah.
right, reached the lowest order of life endowed with the potential of immortality. That's a profound status statement. We are the bottom of existence that can live on without ceasing, right? Immortality.
Right.
And then this mighty messenger says, and now I am dispatched from Salvington, one time a mortal of origin on an evolutionary world of space. So in other words, I'm a being who started at the bottom with you and ascended,
yeah.
right? To elaborate.
And I'm coming
and
back.
I'm coming back to elaborate and continue the recital of the eternal purpose of the gods, respecting the ascending orders of sonship, more particularly with regard to the mortal creatures of time and space. So to me, this is a statement about integration up and
yes.
down, all the way
yeah.
across the spectrum.
From
yeah.
top and bottom. Yeah.
Yeah. And what he's doing is setting out, he's saying, you know, this is all about coming down from the highest levels and ascending from the lowest levels and knitting the whole thing together into an integrated whole. That's what
right.
this whole universe age of the Supreme is about.
Right.
That's what the gods are engaged in, and all beings are engaged in, and we ourselves. So it's this integration of the ascension and the descension that they're trying to set out, which is gorgeous. It's a gorgeous concept.
It is
yeah.
a gorgeous concept. That's a great word way to describe it.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely gorgeous and new to us on this world, that the universe
mm-hmm.
cares so much for us, that we're not forgotten, not far
mm-hmm.
from it, anything but it.
Yeah.
You know?
Interesting detail here about how this mighty messenger says that he or she is literally dispatched from Salvington, dispatched
mm-hmm.
from Salvington, meaning
yeah.
here to our world.
Yeah.
To elaborate and continue the recital of the eternal purpose of the gods. And boy, what an assignment. You know what I mean? All the mighty messengers. to be selected to come here, you know, the bestowal world of Michael, to offer this service of writing up this paper.
I love his recap, like, too.
Yeah.
This is what we've
yeah.
covered. Boom. And now I'm here to tell you this.
Very, very gifted skills as a teacher, you know,
yes.
on display here.
Yes.
Which is cool to think about. But what I wonder is about is how this particular mighty messenger was selected for this assignment, how that happened. If, like, billions of them all signed up on Salvington, I want to do it. But somehow or other, they picked this one who's writing this paper. Anyway, it's just kind of funny to think about the backstory on some of these beings.
It speaks.
And how they came to write these papers. I don't know.
It speaks to some of the cool assignments we might get.
Yeah, right. Right.
In the future, right? And wouldn't that be delightful?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, and it also, you know, sort of incorporates the understanding that a mighty messenger comes from a rebellion world. I mean, came from an evolutionary world like
yes.
ours, which was all messed up by rebellion, and stood firm and had his earliest experiences as a mortal being on an inhabited world in a context that is something like ours.
Yeah,
you
loyal.
Know, which,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, went through. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How wonderful to pick an ascending sun to write this paper.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one that has done
but
it.
But one of
the
particular
way.
Experiences similar
yeah.
to ours.
Yes,
in relation to
very similar to ours. Do you think we'll meet him?
I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Great question.
We'll
do you think
off.
I can get him to sign my book?
Yeah.
I would love that. I don't know what I'll say to him. I can't. The gratitude just is too great. It's too great.
I have a feeling we will get to meet. We'll have an author's party at some point.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, in the same way, think about how personal the universe is and how personal Michael is as the ruler of this universe. And we know from his life here just how wonderful and personal he is. But if we'd only known him as Michael, we may have gotten an idea of his graciousness and everything, but
right.
we would have been maybe a little too awestruck by his position and his responsibilities,
yeah.
or however we might
right.
frame that. But I'm struck always by the memory of that one thing that they speak about, that it was just a little over, almost 500 years ago, that Michael was on Gerizim for the dedication of the Michael Memorial. Now, to me, that's a significant statement because of the imaginative possibilities. One, 500 years before the revelation was in about the 1400s, the late 1400s, okay? Or 1430-something. But in any case, that would have given many of the human beings that were alive at the time of Michael time to progress through the mansion worlds, time to acquire Gerizim citizenship, and the consciousness, the education, the culture, the appreciation for what Michael's return for them might actually represent as Michael, and getting to meet him as the Creator Son in his Creator Son form for the first time, the apostles, the disciples, all those that had progressed up to that time, by that point, foregathered, even if they hadn't made it through all the mansion worlds by then, but probably they had. And then moving them onto, even if they hadn't, getting them over there for that occasion, they would have had some appreciation. So to me, that's a remarkable statement of the personality and how Michael would have wanted that. How Michael wanted to be there with those he had been with for that dedication of the Michael Memorial, because it's significant to him. It's an achievement. And it's not just an achievement. It's an achievement that has all kinds of personal and personality ramifications for all those that were involved with that. So that, to harken back to your point earlier, Paula, and some of the points that you were making, Marvin, about, you know, just what a wonderful universe we live in, how loving it is. And
right.
That's just easy to forget on our own. That's why I value, you know, my fellowship in the Revelation. I would forget about all this stuff if I was just by myself all the time. In fact, I am by myself too much of the time. But
you're so engaged, though. My God,
virtual fellowship, and that gets me through to the next.
I thought your comment it was really sweet and kind of. Well, it's just a really neat comment you made, Paula, about how wonderful to meet this mighty messenger. And what it kind of brought up for me, and we talk about this every now and then. It's not a subject comes up very often. But, you know, as we proceed in the earlier stages, especially of the universe career, but I think all the way through, this initial life, they apply as a very impactful part of it all. And one of the things that is interesting to me is, you know, we will always be identified, especially in the local universe, as natives of the nativity sphere of Michael, of Jesus, and the life he spent on this planet, and of its rebellion-tossed nature. And so, you know, we'll be a group of people associated with Urantia as a world and as a challenging place to have spent our initial life. But the additional thing is, you know, at this point, we're a very small group of people in this generation and the last generation that were alive and shared and served and tried to work together to accomplish things, make contributions in relation to the earliest stages of this fifth epical revelation. And that kind of forms us as a cohort, I think, in ways that I think also are kind of special. And I rather suspect that we who love this revelation will have the opportunity to interact with and get to know and love and be taught further by some of these ascending and descending personalities that have given us this revelation, as in a sense a cohort that we're dedicated to continuing and expanding their work and doing something evolutionarily productive with it in our generation. So I think there are those sort of cultural identifiers and cohesive factors really do play a part in who we are going forward and the experiences that we will have. And I know you guys do. I'm really looking forward to it. It's really an exciting part of the whole thing, too, I think.
You know what comes to mind for me in this discussion is just supreme joy. And the supreme joy that we experience around little things. Little things like sharing milestones in our life with the people we love. And Andre's comment about the Michael Memorial and his desire to share that with the people that he loves, and which is so many. You know, we desire to share our milestones with the people that we love, the people that know us and love us. And, you know, that is something that's borrowed, I believe, from the divine heart. We didn't come up with it. It's not unique to us. When Jesus said to Gana, did we not supremely enjoy this ministry? of restoring the lost child to his home? Does he not supremely enjoy every aspect of his association with us? Does he not supremely enjoy the satisfaction of restoring the lost sheep to the fold in Nebadon? You know, does he not supremely enjoy an intimate association with each of us, all of us? He does. And we supremely enjoy it. And that's borrowed from the divine heart. We didn't come up with that. That's in us. That's God in us, enjoying every little thing, every little enjoyable thing. From, you know, and service, of course, is probably one of the most enjoyable things of all. It's the great secret.
That's really cool that you mentioned that, Paula, because I think one of the challenges, in a way, that we all face is opening ourselves up to the enjoyment of our relationship with God.
Yeah.
You know, we come out of all these traditions and things where maybe God is, like, scary or remote or who knows what. But to actually enjoy our relationship with Jesus, with the Father, with the angels, with the Mother Spirit, you know, with all the deities that provide this replete ministry. But to literally enjoy that is a great thought. I like that. And not only enjoy it, but supremely enjoy it. We have to spend some time with that intention, I think. Really open ourselves up to the presence of God to such an extent that we can have that feeling that he has for us. I mean, you know, it'll never be, you know, it's something we can grow into. And it's something we grow into, in other words. Our joy and grows.
Certainly parenthood teaches you more about that than anything, right? Because you get down in the grass with your little two-year-old and look at a caterpillar.
Right.
And you see it through her eyes.
Good point.
It gives your heart such joy. Mm-hmm. You would probably ignore it otherwise. But because she sees it and is full of wonder about it, you get down in the grass with her and see it through her eyes. And that's a supreme enjoyment. There's just nothing better than that. To feel her little hand in yours, or his little hand, as she puts it in your hand. That's supreme. And you know, God feels that way about us, and it's so important to understand the simple, beautiful joy of that relationship, that you don't have to impress anybody. You don't have to wow them with your great intellect or your magnificent self. You're just a kid in the universe, and they love you. Just the way you are. You don't have to be anything more than what you are, and they just love you for it. All the potential you hold, and I think we read that too, you know, that you start out from the bottom. These mortals, the lowest rung on the ladder, and they cherish it. They cherish being able to come out. It's like when you read that, I thought of the seed, you know. Here's the seed. You don't think, well, it's just a seed. Not worth much. You certainly cherish the wonderful plant it becomes. But there, all of that potential is held within that seed. And how much joy it gives you to tenderly plant that and give it the things it needs. And watch it grow with great anticipation of what it will become. Whether that takes one growing season or 30 years. The joy the anticipation and the joy of the potential, the celebration of the potential is always there. From the seed all the way up. And that's us. You know, once again, they just... their love comes through. Their gracious condescension comes through in spades.
Mm-hmm. Well, the whole concept of worship points to the idea that there's great pleasure to be found just in being with God.
Yeah.
You know, sharing the moment.
Just being present.
Feeling. Right. There was a great comment that Jonathan Osteen made once. He's the son of Joel Osteen, if you know anything about that family.
Yeah.
But he was given a talk about the love of the Father, and he made a comment that stuck with me, which is that, you know, we think we have to pray for all kinds of things, but the Father already knows about all our needs, right? And the, what he was getting to is the idea that the Father just wants to hear from us, right?
Yeah.
You know, we don't need to make a recital of all their pleas and requests and longings and stuff. You know, he already knows about all that. He just wants to hear from us, right?
Yeah.
It's like a kid who's gone off to college, you know, and the parents don't hear from him for a couple months. And then he finally calls and the parents are, wow, so good to hear from you, you know.
Yeah.
There's that. Yeah, there's that longing for contact that grows with separation. And in a way, God is farther away and closer to us than any other being in the universe.
Right.
And the idea that God loves us, and, you know, that it goes parallels to the thing in the book about how doing the will of God is nothing more or less than, you know, the willingness to share the inner life. And it's kind of in that same spirit that God just wants to hear from us, just wants to wants us to desire to be with him.
Just not put our little outcome. Hand in his.
not for any, you know, thing. It's not for like, you know, it's not like making a deal. Okay, if I pray for 10 minutes, no, maybe I'll get some of the stuff I want. You know,
right.
It's not like that. There's just inherent pleasure in sharing time together.
Right.
With deity.
And knowing you are loved and trusted.
And that's a mutual, that's mutual pleasure.
Yeah.
What's like you're saying, Father, that's, we understand that best from our parental experiences. We can
yeah.
see, oh, okay, I put myself in God's position as a, you know, as a parent and really appreciate
and,
that.
And our grandparental experience, Chuck, which you are about to
sure.
have. God bless you, brother.
Oh, that's
yeah.
right.
God bless
yeah.
your beautiful child who is about to give birth here pretty soon. Coming
mm-hmm.
up fast.
Indeed.
What a wonderful life, you know. I feel blessed to study with you guys because it leads here so often of the time. It leads to a place of deep, profound gratitude for the many blessings we have. Just to know truth and be able to revel in the joy of being a part of our Father's universe of universes.
Yeah,
it
feels beautiful, Paula.
Yeah.
Feels very, very mutual.
Yeah.
It's just such an interesting experience. You know, so much of our lives are mundane and taken up with just feeling like mundane details. And then there are parts of our lives, and this is an experience I think the four of us really enjoy, and those who listen, and we're glad you're with us, of immersing ourselves in something sacred, which is this revelation that shows us all these things, and sharing our experiences in and around it, and being fed at a very deep level. And it's at the upper ranges of the experience of value in this life for me, and I think for all of us. And what an amazing blessing that we've had in our lives to have this revelation and to be able to share our experiences in our lives, our service efforts, our love for each other, our relationships with God and with each other in association with an ethical revelation. It's wow. It's really just been a gift, you know,
yeah.
in this life.
It's a gift. Such a gift.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You think of the effort that they put into bringing it to us. It's like, thank you, guys. You're awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you so
yeah.
much.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That we can
feeling
be blessed by it.
Yeah, and just, I'm glad you expressed it, you know, to share our profound appreciation to this mighty messenger and to all of these celestial beings who labored so fully for our uplift and our welfare, and it's making a huge difference. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
Yeah, you're here. Well, that's about it for us today, you guys. That was a great beginning of our study of the Ascending Sons of God, which won't be a difficult paper to get through. It's not that long or hard, but who knows where it'll lead. I'm looking forward to it. So, as always, I appreciate you. I love seeing you guys on the board, all of you, Herschel, Robert, Isadora, Kurt, Perry, wow, it's so always so great to see you. Trudy came in to say you were mowing the lawn, yay. She was listening to us while mowing the lawn. That was great. Loved it. So, and it's always great, our listeners.
Yeah.
And John, yeah. Thanks, you guys.
John.
And all those listeners who will listen on the archive, we appreciate you. So have a great week. Just
enjoy,
be with
the
God.
The long weekend down here, south of the border.
Yeah. Everyone stay
Memorial Day.
Stay spirit connected. Stay connected with God. That's where the love all comes from.
That's where it is. That's the source. Love you guys.
So true. All right.
Love you guys too.
Till next time.
Have a great weekend.
Bye for now. You too.
Bye for now.
Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.